You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, good friend of the program, Adam Spinella, is here. We're at school with Adam today. It's going to be a nice little fun time. And obviously, we are going to break down everything we just saw from Victor Wembanyama. Unfortunately, the second game of this Scoot versus Vic showdown did not necessarily materialize in the way that we had hoped, because Scoot and Vic kind of banged knees in the first quarter, and out of an abundance of caution, it would seem, based off of Scoot's quotes after the game, the G League Ignite decided to kind of shut down Scoot Henderson for the rest of this game. But we saw everything that we could have hoped to have seen from these two guys over the course of this three-day little adventure in Las Vegas. Adam Spinella, I talked to Ricky O'Donnell on Tuesday night. Tonight I'm talking to you. How excited are you about what we just saw over these 3 days?
Yeah, so, I mean, first of all, what an exciting first game. I know I didn't have the opportunity to chime in with you and Ricky on Tuesday night, who, you know, shout out Ricky, the absolute best.
As folks can tell, Adam's voice is a bit gravelly right now.
We're battling.
He's getting back. Yeah.
Yeah. We're battling from a week long cold here, but the Tuesday night game was so much fun, from the opening play with, you know, Victor basically going ISO mode to a fading bank shot from 17 feet all the way through to the final buzzer with Scoot kind of taking over in the fourth quarter. What an unbelievable game top to bottom. Today, you know, still a really well-played and fun game, I thought. The Scoot banging of knees, and I hesitate to even call it an injury. He banged his knee. But him not being in the matchup definitely soured a little bit in terms of what everybody was hoping for from the experience. It certainly does not put a damper on what Victor Wembanyama is. I mean, I hesitate to call him a basketball player. I don't know whether I should call him an alien. Like, what is the proper word to describe what the hell he has shown over the last 3 days here?
Yeah, like LeBron James called him an alien, called him a generational player, said basically the word unicorn does not define Victor Wembanyama. It's just what we saw from Vic over the last couple of days is every single plausible thing that we could have asked for from him. You and I on this show over the course of the last, you know, month or so, we've talked a lot about the skills that we would like to see Vic showcase over the course of this season. Over the course of this season, not over the course of 2 days. We literally saw everything that we could have hoped for from Victor Wembanyama over these 3 days, I guess, two games. One thing that we were worried about was the shooting. Like, we would like to see Victor Wembanyama consistently knock down shots. Last year, he shot, I think, 27.5% from three. He was pulling up from fucking 30 feet in this game. I mean, good Lord. He hit The most ridiculous shot I've ever seen a 7-footer hit in my life. By the way, Victor Wembanyama is 7'5". The difference between him and a 7-footer is the difference between someone who is like 6'7" and a center foot, a 7-footer. He hit a shot in transition where he like caught just like a little trailer dump off, took one dribble, took two steps from above the break into the corner and hit a fading, falling away three-pointer from the corner, fading to his right, which is typically a harder shot for a righty. And frankly, not a shot we saw Victor Wembanyama bring out of his arsenal in the first game. We saw a lot of step backs to his left in the first game. The fact that he made that shot just completely blew my mind. We saw like a dream shake mid-range shot. Like,
yeah. And we saw a dream shake kind of one in each half going over each shoulder, you know, one on the baseline in the first half, one in the second half. Like the impressive part about that three-pointer that you're describing where he takes one dribble and gets all the way from, you know, the coach's hash to the corner, essentially, is the elevation that he got on his shot. He wasn't fading out of bounds. He was able to get his feet fully underneath him, rise straight up, and have pristine mechanics with his wrist flick. I mean, it's so impressive what he's doing as a shooter. I think he was 9 of 18 from 3 across the two games combined, 7 of 11 in the first contest, 2 of 7, I believe, today. But just he is a legitimate shooter. Whatever he's put in over the summer – just to get that a little bit more consistent. We've all known he has shooting potential and really good touch, yeah. But his footwork, his lower body mechanics, how he's able to jump straight up and have a strong release on top of that, he's so good.
I mean, and we saw like a rip through drive going to his left, spinning back to his right in the first half. I'll be honest, I thought that this game for Vic offensively and frankly, like in terms of some other things like rebounding and just overall like defensive, I don't even want to say IQ and like, you know, positioning, because I think that Scoot just kind of puts so much pressure on a defense that it was easier for Vic today without Scoot in the lineup because of his athleticism. But just across the board, like Vic had 10 rebounds in this game. He was really, really steady and solid on the glass. Like that, he was consistent in terms of protecting the rim. Like all of it across the board, on top of the shot creation, on top of the mid-range stuff. So like you and I have been a little bit hesitant, not a lot hesitant, but like a little bit hesitant to like throw around generational and throw around like he's 100% a better prospect than Zion, he's 100% a better prospect than Anthony Davis. Like if this continues throughout the course of the season, there is like no circumstance that any team would not take him number one overall over Anthony Davis. He's 7'5", like period, point blank. Like he is 7'5" and is this kind of shot creator, this kind of polished playmaker. It's really just kind of incredible. I don't know. My mind is a little bit blown. It's rare that I struggle to come up with words on stuff like this, but I am. We saw a guy that is 7'5", whose release point is frankly like over 10 feet. Like it's higher, like he shoots the ball with a high release point. He actually elevates into his jumper. Like that's the thing. Like it's not like a set shot. Like when you watch Kristaps Porzingis, like it's a set shot for the most part, right? Vic elevates into this thing and like actually has balance and it's grace and fluidity. It's not normal. It's just so not normal.
Well, and the confidence. The confidence that he takes all of these shots with. There's a difference between having a green light to let stuff fly and taking shots that you genuinely believe are going to go in. And it seems that every one of these that he takes, however bold they are when he is really pulling, he believes that every single one of them is going to go in. You know, I go back to one of the first scrimmages that we saw from him this year with Metropolitans, where he took kind of like a one-legged step back in transition on the left wing and like it didn't go in, but my God, just the the cojones, I keep saying.
The audacity.
He's nuts. And you know what? He's proving time and time again that he can make tough, things that we can't fathom from a jump shooter. He can do. I want to keep seeing him go further. Like, it's simultaneously mind-blowing and fun while also being just this unbelievable lesson as an evaluator that there is no blueprint for a guy like this. Like, even comparing him to an Anthony Davis, yeah, a Rudy Gobert, who else you want to talk about? You know, I hear Kevin Durant combined with Rudy Gobert. Like, there is no blueprint for what he does on either end of the floor. He's just already one of a kind.
So I went back yesterday, like spent a good portion of the day yesterday really digging deep into like, okay, what past precedents do we have for this? Right. I went back, I found any sort of like highlights that I could find of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, aka Lew Alcindor, at the time at UCLA. I dug deep. I like tried to find like Ralph Sampson highlights, which are more in copious amounts on YouTube, which is good. Arvydas Sabonis, you and I have talked about that before. Like, you can find those online pretty easily. When he was young in Russia, I went back, I tried to find Yao Ming. I couldn't find like anything out of China with Yao Ming, but like I tried to find like early like Houston Yao Ming, Shaquille O'Neal. Like, and the other thing I did, I went back and I watched the other like elite prospect games that we've seen, right? So like one of them that I went back and watched was Shaquille O'Neal against Christian Laettner. Right. Like, Christian Laettner was this incredibly famous, like, made the goddamn dream team rookie out of, or, senior out of Duke. Shaquille O'Neal was a junior at LSU. And oh my goodness. I mean, Duke won the game, but like the first half that Shaquille O'Neal like put up, he just completely altered the game, like geometrically, in the way that you see from Vic. Now, it was totally different because Shaq was just like so strong and explosive and physical that he'd just move guys around, right? Like, nobody could establish position against him. He could run the court. It made me remember that I still think we drastically underrate how good Shaquille O'Neal was somehow. And like almost makes me like understand like how his attitude sometimes can seem like it is on NBA, TNT, NBA on TNT. Like, I get it. I couldn't really find a perfect comparison point for Vic. The closest I think is probably Ralph Sampson in terms of like, okay, he could step away and shoot. He was 7'4", so like he had the crazy length. He was a real athlete. He had real balance and grace. But like, even Ralph, it's not like he could step away and like handle the ball and break guys down off the dribble. Like, a lot of it was like post, mid post, maybe he catches and shoots from 20 feet away. Like, we haven't seen this before. I think that like Kareem was a better prospect. Like Lew Alcindor's first game, he scored 56 points at UCLA. And look, he was as a sophomore, right? Because freshmen couldn't play then. So he was, I think, 20 at the time. But they literally had to outlaw the fucking dunk to stop him from being so dominant in college basketball. They outlawed the dunk for a decade because Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was so good at college basketball. Think about that for a second. Think about how good this guy was. I don't think that Wembanyama is that good yet. I think that, like, outside of LeBron, Kareem, the highest of the highest high-level players, I think I'm basically willing to listen at this point. He is a genuinely completely novel player.
Yep. Yeah, he is. And it's, he's 18 years old. Sam, like, we still know he has so much more to grow, not necessarily physically. Like, that would cause my jaw to drop even farther than it already is right now if he ends up taller and longer. But learning how to play to his game, like we said, there's no real blueprint for a player that combines all of the skills and styles that he brings to the table. So it's going to take a lot of visionary thinking, a lot of people around him who can just put him in different situations and trial by fire. This is how teams are guarding me. Here's how I have to react. He shows the ability to shoot off the dribble from three, to shoot on the move, to be a catch and shoot guy. He definitely has the ability to score on the interior near the basket, whether that's catch and finish or even face up driving. What we've seen this week are the creative isolation moves, whether it's face up on a bigger guy where he can make, you know, one spin move and end up going from the elbow to the mid post on the other side of the floor, whether it's, you know, face up on a smaller guy where he tries to, you know, Euro step around him and brings the ball over the top into a really delicate touch finger roll at the front of the basket, or it's back to the basket moves where he's surveying if a double team is coming and then hitting these baseline ridiculous fadeaways where he's half cut off by the backboard or going over either shoulder. That's what makes this so fascinating. There's not going to be an offensive shot in his bag that he can't go to. It's about the growth that he has of recognition of when to use each of them. And he's already pretty solid in that regard. I think he can still get better as a passer. That's pretty clear. But there's no limit to what you can teach him and what he's going to be able to put into practice once he develops that feel.
Right. I think that's the key kind of terminology that I wrote about for this morning at The Athletic. That's why, as long as everything clears in terms of health checks and everything this year, he stays healthy and everything checks out there. That's why he's going to go number one over Scoot Henderson. It's because there really isn't a limit to what he can do in terms of his development. You just kind of go through each of the disparate parts of his game and there's room for growth in each. Like, he can become an even better shooter. He can continue to develop his ball handling a little bit more. He will technically clean up some of the like pick and roll coverage issues that he has right now, where in space, like, he'll kind of just get wrong footed or he'll have his hips turned too early and, you know, maybe not be quite as effective. Like, you saw Scoot kind of blow by him a couple of times in that first game. You know, there he'll get more strong. He'll get stronger physically, right? Like, we can keep going down the list, right? There isn't really a limit, though. With him, you can't teach 7'5". You can't teach an 8-foot wingspan. And you can't teach this incredible balance with all of the skills that he's already developed. With Scoot Henderson, like, you just kind of can't fix 6'2". And as good as Scoot Henderson is, and I think he has a case to be, like, the best guard prospect in many, many, many years. I think he is, frankly, a better guard prospect than Ja Morant was coming out of Murray State. I think he's a better guard prospect than Anthony Edwards was coming out of Georgia. I think that he is, like, ahead of just about all of these guys. Like, maybe you can make the case like Derrick Rose. Like, there are a lot of, I don't know that I want to, like, dive deep. The two names that I've gotten the most when it comes to, like, comparing stylistically, Scoot Henderson is Derrick Rose and Ja Morant. I think it's a little bit more Derrick Rose. I think that the point they bring up with Ja is he has that same killer mentality where, like, he wants to just go out and absolutely obliterate everyone every single time he steps on the court. It's just that he's 6'2" and Victor Wembanyama is 7'5", and Vic is already a better shot maker, and he's just such a defensive, like, difference maker. Like, Scoot Henderson does not genuinely change the geometry of a basketball game. He is unbelievable, and his decision-making is incredible, and I want to dive deeper with you into Scoot as soon as we're done with this, because I do genuinely think he, even though he got hurt today, like, I just want to hear your take on what game one looked like, even though I've talked about it already. He's just, like, absolutely incredible, phenomenal. He's not, like, game-changing level talent in the way that Vic is. And unfortunately for Scoot, like, I think he would have been the no-doubter number one overall pick in 2017, in 2020, in 2022, like at least half of the last like six or seven drafts, he would have been like a no question number one overall pick. Cade Cunningham, Zion Williamson, I think there'd probably be questions, but like that's the ballpark that he's in as a prospect.
Yep.
Scoot Henderson just isn't Victor Wembanyama, and that's fine. And we'll see where it goes from here.
Yeah. Look, when I keep thinking about ceiling for Victor Wembanyama and how much room he has to continue to get better, look at any star player that we have in the NBA, the number one option on any team right now currently, or even narrow it down further from that to the top maybe 10 best offensive players in the league. What position area on the court do you put those guys in to be successful that you can't see a situation where Victor Wembanyama can replicate it? Giannis Antetokounmpo getting downhill in transition. Vic's definitely not as powerful as him, but he's long and plays angles, and because of his handle, is going to be able to get and put pressure on the rim. You know, I think that there's definitely an upside and ability for him to play with his back to the basket in those mid-post situations to be just a consistent, lethal killer like Kevin Durant has been. Any type of star offensive player, I think there's a realm where you can say he adds this to his game. Maybe, you know, Embiid is a little bit different because of the power, but I think he can play back to the basket on the blocks if you really needed him to. It's just he's so much better at other things that that's probably not a great return for Vic. So my upside and brimming for him is he can combine elite skills that we've already seen and currently see from top 10 players in the NBA. The defensive end of the floor is also really fascinating to me. You know, you'd mentioned right off the top the difference of not having Scoot Henderson today, of, you know, less athleticism, rim pressure, that quickness to really threaten him in those situations. He definitely seemed more comfortable. I thought in the first game he was relatively jumpy, trying to move his feet to block shots. And somebody's got to pull him aside and just be like, dude, you have an 8-foot wingspan. Just put your hand up and you're going to alter the shot. You don't have to leave your feet to chase down blocks every single time. And I thought he was better with that today. There was one sequence in the second half when the Ignite had, I think, a throw ahead in transition, trying to look for an early dunk. And he was just in the area. And I forget who the offensive player was. It might have been Sissoko. Saw that he was there, didn't go up quickly, kind of reverse pivoted, tried to gather himself, and then go up a second time. And Vic stayed patient and swatted that one towards the sideline. Like he can be patient and understand the rules are different for him defensively because of his size and his length, of how much space he eats, his ability to recover on things. Like, you can play a different style. On the interior, you don't have to leave your feet as much. You don't have to jump to try to block every shot. You alter it just by being big. On the perimeter, you can probably gamble a little bit more, reach in and try to grab a steal because your length is going to allow you to recover in straight lines. We saw that with the first play of the game. You know, the Ignite tried to get him on that spin backdoor lob. He's overplaying and the lob looked like it was there. He's just too long. He can get to those plays. There's nothing you can do as an offense.
There's zero margin for error. There is genuinely zero margin for error when he is around the basket. Let's talk about Scoot Henderson now. I just want to get your take on game one, because I went back and watched it to write the thing that I wrote today. I thought his fourth quarter was even better than his first half. Yep. Like, I know that the first half got all of the accolades and excitement. Oh my God. The way that he diagnosed and understood exactly what Metropolitans was doing and how messy the backside of their defense was in terms of communication. There were so many little miscommunications on the backside of their defense. The way that he diagnosed that and figured it out, oh my God, he was absolutely incredible, I thought. He was absolutely amazing. He is not just an athlete. He is a real, genuine point guard. He is an unbelievable playmaker, passer for others. He has the real mid-range game. I adore Scoot Henderson. I love him.
Yep. More space for him to operate in when he came off those pick and rolls. I thought that the Ignite the rest of the teammates were very patient around him and trying to make his reads either simpler or just give him a runway to be able to get to the basket at times, which I appreciated because I think when you have a special talent athletically like he is, you've got to try to keep the game incredibly simple and bank on his talent being able to carry you to making the right play time and time again. And in the fourth quarter, he proved that. You know, I found it interesting. I think a lot of times star players almost flip the script from the way that Scoot came out in this game. They start the game trying to operate and create for others because in theory, if you get everybody else going, they can stay hot. They stay engaged in other areas. And then defenses are less focused on you, where when it's fourth quarter, games on the line, you go into a little bit more takeover mode and try to score for yourself. Scoot did the exact opposite. He came out swinging. And he was out to prove a point right from the jump that, you know, his jump shot has improved. He's going to be able to get to the rim, and he is unafraid of attacking Vic, whether it's in drop coverage, in switches and isolations, one-on-one. He was going right at Vic. And he wasn't making bad decisions. I think a lot of times the game within a game can detract from the end result, and I didn't think it did for Scoot in the first half.
Yeah.
But he was incredibly savvy in the fourth quarter to kind of realize, you know what, I can get into the heart of this defense and get somebody else a wide open shot time and time again. And I didn't think he forced any bad ones in that fourth quarter, where it's not just about the number of great passes he made, but I don't think he coughed away other possessions by saying, okay, I've done this enough, now it's my turn to go get a bucket. Just very unselfish, make the right type of play every single time. When you talk about that killer, I'll prove it to you instinct that Ja Morant had, it's the combination of that with the ability to set that me part aside and just make the right decision for us as a team that really gets me to buy into Scoot Henderson being special at the next level. That all of his physical gifts, his ability to create his own shot is great. He's going to value making the right play. And maybe it's the coach in me, and it's a little cynical at times, but I think the basketball gods reward those who just continually make the right play.
Okay, so we're about to get a fairly epic tanking race this year, is what it feels like, right? Like, that's where this is all leading to. We have these two prospects that are very clearly like number one overall caliber prospects, including one in Victor Wembanyama that is like genuinely franchise altering, right? That's where we are. He's a genuine franchise changer. If you get to select him at the top of the draft. Having said that, with lottery odds being as flat as they are now, it's going to be fairly difficult for teams to like really lock in those top three lottery odds, which are all the same. And we've seen teams since these lottery odds have been flatted kind of rise up over from the middle of that lottery range into that number one overall pick spot, number two overall pick spot. So yes, I understand that like it's harder to get like the level of losses that you have to get. San Antonio is going to be an absolute disaster this year, I think. Indiana is probably not going to be very good. The Jazz, like, I don't know. Like, I think the Jazz are going to be pretty bad, but like they have some vets on that team that might like kind of up the level of play a little bit, especially in the early portion of the season. You know, maybe the Rockets are not very good, although I think they're going to be a little bit better. Oklahoma City, you know, God, like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, like Sam Presti might not let Shai Gilgeous-Alexander back into the building at this point, like in order to get Vic. What do we think the tanking structure of the NBA looks like this year? I feel like it might be off the rails.
Yeah, it does seem that way. I mean, I've never heard of a one-game performance from a prospect where the entire world community is talking about shutting him down, which I don't think Victor Wembanyama should ever entertain the possibility. He needs on-ball creation reps. He needs the ability to explore the space of being a number one option and learn how to react to all of these different situations that he's going to be placed in. So by no means should he shut it down and try to avoid the injury talk, so to speak. From a team standpoint, look, there are definitely those that are already committed to the rebuilding youth movement timeline, where this year is not about trying to win games. San Antonio and Oklahoma City are probably the two that stand out the most. I think there are also some teams that are understanding that's the process they're going to move in, but want to give maybe a little bit of a shot with the veterans that they have, or don't buy into the full retool experience from day one. I think Indiana and Utah in particular, like, they have enough intriguing veterans. What I'm really surveying right here is, I think you and Ricky mentioned it on your podcast on Tuesday, this is a draft that has two number one picks.
Yeah.
That you don't have to come up with number one or bust. That as long as you jump into that top two, you are getting a legitimate game-changing, franchise-altering prospect. And who knows? Maybe as the season goes on, there's another guy who clearly jumps into that list. So yeah. I think that further makes tanking less of a risk than it might with the flattened odds in another year.
The interesting part of it is, to me, some of these teams that we're expecting to be competitive, right? Like Detroit, Houston will be a little bit more competitive. Orlando should be way more competitive. If they're not, like, especially the Eastern Conference teams, because the Western Conference teams, it's going to be hard for them not to at least be in the play-in picture because of how bad, like, Utah, Oklahoma City, San Antonio, those three particularly are going to be, and probably Houston. Did I say Houston already? The four bad ones are going to be Oklahoma City, Utah, Houston, and who's the fourth one?
San Antonio. Yeah.
San Antonio. That's right. So there's going to be 11 teams vying for 10 play-in spots. So I think it's going to be kind of hard for them to, like, really truly ever kind of drop out. Right. In the East, though, like, a team like Detroit, a team like Orlando, at what point do they decide, oh my God, like, we're probably out of the play-in picture because the East at the top is, like, kind of deep. Or if we are, like, we can't really make, like, the high-end playoffs, or we're going to have to play Boston or Philadelphia in the first round. What's the point, right? At what point, like, does it happen in January where, like, Detroit's like, well, Cade, you know, you've got, like, kind of a little, you know, I know your calf's not feeling great right now. Let's give you a month and a half just to kind of sit down, you know, and maybe we'll bring you back later in the year if things go okay. Like, at what point does that happen? Typically, it happens around, like, March. Does it happen in, like, late January this year where teams start to, like, drop off a little bit?
Yeah, there's another part of this, which I don't know how fully I get on board with, but the incentive of teams like Indiana and Utah to maybe move some of their vets right away, something that they might, you know, mm-hmm. want to hold on a little bit more towards January, February, because you might have a little bit more leverage around the deadline, or there are some injuries that play out that really allow a different team to be a suitor than there is around right now. I don't know if they can hang on that long, because they might win too many games to take them out of the sweepstakes for something like this. And if their goal is to put themselves in contention for it, they're making these deals in early December 15th is when players are eligible to be traded, I believe. So, like, we may see some, you know, mid to late December deals, as opposed to waiting all the way to January, February, when we start to see some movement.
Or, like, do we see Utah, like, make a move now? Do we see Utah just go, like, shit, like, we got Jordan Clarkson, we got Malik Beasley, we got Mike Conley. Like, there are going to be too many games where these guys just kind of shoot us into games. We need to move these guys. Like, honestly, like, do we see, like, Utah go in early early October, late October here, just decide, you know, we don't have a needle mover, frankly, like, we don't have the guy on our roster that matters in terms of winning long term in the NBA. What do we do? Like, do we just move all these guys and try and, like, tank for Vic? Honestly, like, I kind of think, like, I think they should, if I'm being completely transparent with it. Like, Utah should be moving these guys, like, now. I've been pretty low on Utah. Like, I did not think that they would really find all that much success this season. But I don't know. Like, some of these teams, like Oklahoma City, San Antonio, like, they're really, really bad. They're, like, really desperately bad. And if you win four games early that you shouldn't win, that might be enough to, like, really push you into a different stratosphere of where it'd be difficult for you to, like, really lose enough games late in the year to where you're in this mix. I don't know. Like, if I was Indiana, maybe you move Miles Turner a little bit earlier. Maybe you move Buddy Hield a little bit earlier. You give the reins to Tyrese Halliburton, Ben Mathurin, Chris Duarte, and Isaiah Jackson. And that's a fun core, and Indiana fans should be pumped, but that's probably not a core that's going to win a lot of NBA games in 2023.
Right. Yeah, well, the dark horse team for me in this is Charlotte, because there's just the vibe.
Oh, God.
The vibe.
Have you seen their preseason games?
It's bad. I watched the Celtics one because I cover the Celtics for Celtics, but rough, just really, really rough. Like, not even it's effort based with them right now. And to have that in the preseason with a new coach coming in, like, there's serious worries that I have with Charlotte. So I would not be surprised if they get to that, like, mid-December period and they're one of the worst teams in the NBA. And they're like, we have to go all in on Vic.
I wouldn't blame them. Like, and look, it's preseason. Like, maybe, but you and I have had, like, real concerns about Charlotte's talent level, like, the whole preseason, like, coming into the year and the offseason stuff. I don't know, man. LaMelo's good, but, like, is LaMelo good enough to lift the entire roster there? I mean, man, I don't know if you saw James Bouknight last night, like, trying to get around Aaron Naismith. Like, Aaron Naismith isn't the fleetest of foot guy. Like, all due respect to Aaron, I think he's, like, a rotation player long term in the NBA, but, like, I mean, he, like, couldn't even get past half court against Aaron Naismith. And, like, this is a guy whose ball handling and, like, shot creation ability is, it's the whole pitch with him. Like, I've got real questions about Charlotte. I've got real concerns about what they look like right now.
Yeah, me too. And, well, the other two teams that I wanted to hit on, or I guess three here in terms of the tanking discussion, are Houston, Orlando, and Detroit. Teams that have already acquired what they believe to be their franchise cornerstones. And there's a lot of growth that can happen from having those guys, keeping a veteran or two around, and trying to win basketball games. Once you've got your cornerstones, everything is about figuring out how to fit pieces on top of them. Now, the flip side of that coin is those cornerstones and the young rosters they've already built with a Scoot Henderson or Victor Wembanyama, that's Oklahoma City Thunder from 15 years ago with back-to-back-to-back drafts of KD, Russ, and Harden. That's the level of talent that we're talking about here. So do I get the appeal? Yes. But I think that there are too many other teams that are going to be bad and or seeing how good Victor and Scoot are and incentivized to strip their rosters down early to the point where I don't think Houston, Orlando, or Detroit can really leapfrog and get back into that top six of draft odds next year.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating as we move forward here. Any other guys with the Ignite that kind of stood out to you? I didn't think that, like, either of the two other prospects on Metropolitans, Koulibaly had a nice little dunk, but, like, is the other one Traore, if I remember correctly? Yeah. I don't think either of those guys, like, really stood out in a big way. I liked Sidy Sissoko in the first game a little bit more than Leonard Miller. I liked Leonard Miller a little bit more in the second game than Sidy Sissoko. I thought Leonard was really rough in the first game, as I talked about with Ricky, but I thought that, you know, I would expect that early in the season from Miller, just because, he's an inconsistent shooter right now. He's never really played off the ball. It's just going to take some time. I thought he was much, much better today. He looked much calmer and, like, a lot. It was like very all over the place in game one, but today he kind of adjusted. I also want to give Leonard Miller some props here real quick.
Okay.
I don't know how many people in Victor Wembanyama's career at this point are going to jump with him at the rim trying to block a shot from Victor Wembanyama, who is 7'5" with an 8-foot wingspan and, like, can actually jump a little bit. Leonard Miller genuinely tried to contest him at the rim today, and I don't mean this in any sort of, like, backhanded way. he got, but I respect the shit out of him for trying. I respect the hell out of him for giving real defensive effort and trying to contest Victor Wembanyama, who the odds are you're going to get absolutely fucking yammed on if you do this. Yep. And he knew that, and he still went for it. I respect the hell out of that.
Totally agree. We tell our guys here in our program all the time, you're not a real baller until you've had your ankles broken or you've been dunked on. It's just it's a rite of passage when you play as much hoops as you do. So don't be ashamed by it. Go and embrace that. Love to see that from Leonard Miller. Yeah. I was always fascinated from watching the dichotomy of how he looked in game one versus game two by how much more comfortable he looks when Scoot isn't on the floor.
Yeah, that's another thing for sure. But you know what, though? Like, it's kind of like I talked about with Ricky. Like, he needs those reps. Like, he needs those reps of playing with another primary ball handler, I think.
He does. And that's why, even though today was a good game from him, it doesn't move the needle much for me from an NBA evaluation standpoint, because I don't see him being more of a primary guy that they run a ton of offense. So he's just very boxy and square, and a lot of his movement abilities below the rim, super bouncy, and does have some feel and creativity with the ball in his hands.
Yeah, good amount of it, honestly. Yeah.
Yeah. Just not a very quick twitch athlete with the ball in his hands, but it was good to see him play a little bit more confidently after what I thought was a rough outing from game one. Sissoko, just to move it there for a second, I was really impressed with his motor in game one. That's what stood out to me the most, that, you know, he and Leonard Miller are both coming into the Ignite with a lot of primary reps under their belt, being the man in the system that they played in before arriving here. And I think there's still a lot of work for Sissoko with learning how to play off the ball more on offense. His jump shot is okay, continuing to get better. But he at least came in there with the mentality of, I'm going to make every hustle play, every effort play, so that I can stay on the floor and be a positive contributor in those areas. So I was just really impressed by some of the intangibles that he showed right from the jump.
Yeah, a couple of questions here to finish on. One of the other players on the Ignite is Mojave King. I've always been a little bit more down on Mojave. I thought he was pretty okay in both these games, to be honest. Like, better than what we'd seen from him at Cairns and Adelaide in those two Next Stars years. Charlie S. asked, like, will Wembanyama now challenge Mojave King for the number one overall pick? Like, great question. Structure, first and foremost. But, like, look, Mojave King, there's a non-zero chance he gets drafted for sure, like, based off of what we've seen so far.
Yeah, I think he had that one movement shot that he was able to hit here in the game today. Like, there's off-ball upside that he's showing. I think that's the key for all of this. You know, there are some really, really talented players in the world, but there are probably 30 to 40 who make it to the NBA to play with the ball in their hands on a consistent basis. So I value off-ball offense a hell of a lot in terms of evaluation, and he is a little bit further along than Sissoko or Leonard Miller right now, and that's going to show time and time again when you play next to a guy like Scoot Henderson.
Yeah, and then from Amin HMD, is Scoot Henderson a generational talent?
You know, I'm very reserved with that word generational. Because you know, generational is what, once in every 60 years, 50 years, 40? Like, how do we define
it? You know what? I would say like 10 is my take on it. Like, once every 10 years, you know, prospect. That's kind of my theory on it. Like, we get one of these guys, like, again, like, you go back through history, right? Like, in the 60s, it was Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. In the late 70s, it was Ralph Sampson. In the, you know, late 70s again, like, Arvydas Sabonis was in Russia, right? In the 90s, like, early 2000s, you had LeBron. You know, Kevin Durant came around in 2007, something like that, right? And Greg Oden, obviously, and Greg just obviously, unfortunately, had the injury history. You know, it seems like it's a once every 10 years kind of thing. Once every 10 to 15, maybe. Shaquille O'Neal in the 90s is maybe like the window in between Ralph Sampson and LeBron James, right? So like once every 10 years, I think is maybe the best way to frame it.
Yeah, he's probably close. I don't know if I'd put him in that category yet. Like I think Zion physically was a little bit more of a freak show in certain ways that I would just say, you know, you're never going to see something like this again. The concept you always talk about of novel versus good. I think Zion proved that he was both novel and good in his 1 year at Duke.
Wembanyama has as well now.
Wembanyama already has. And I don't know if I would put Scoot above Cade Cunningham. You know, I got into this right around the time that Luka Doncic was coming out. He wasn't my clear number one at that time, but looking back, definitely should have been. Like, I don't know if what Scoot is doing now is more impressive than what Doncic did in Europe as a teenager, but he's close. And I don't think it's a crazy question to ask at all.
Yeah, I agree. From Harrison Rich, what are some of your favorite Wembanyama and Scoot landing spots? I answered this with Ricky on the previous pod. I said Oklahoma City for Victor because that just sounds fun to me to see Chet, right? Like Chet would be incredible to me with Victor Wembanyama just because of the length, the shooting, everything like that, right? It's I don't even know that it's like an incredible fit or anything, but it's like one of my favorites and it would be fun. And then Ricky brought up the idea of Houston for Scoot Henderson with just like the Scoot Jalen Green combination in the backcourt with Jabari Smith shooting and what Alperen Şengün can bring to the table. Like kind of that idea was really, really fun to me as well. Who are some of the ones that stand out to you for Vic and Scoot?
Yeah. I mean, it's tough sometimes because you want to look at the young talent to pair them with in this question. And like there are a couple teams out there in Utah and San Antonio we've talked about that don't have that foundational piece yet. So it's hard to include them in this conversation when, quite frankly, I would love to have each prospect and a blank slate to be able to build around the strengths and skills that they bring to the table. That would be really appealing to me. If I have to look at one of the young cores and kind of groups that I would want to put them with, there's an intriguing one for Scoot Henderson to me. That's Indiana.
Ooh.
I would love to see Scoot and Tyrese as a really, really smart, high-level backcourt because of Tyrese's ability to play off ball, Mathurin's shooting ability long-term. I think the Indiana is already building towards a really well-spaced offense that Scoot would thrive in. That's just an intriguing one to me in many regards, but I'm with you 100%. Wemby to Oklahoma City is just, it's what I'm hoping for. I would love to be able to see him and Chet Holmgren just shut off every type of driving lane imaginable to mankind on the defensive end of the floor.
Well, Adam, I don't really want to dig into like the Draymond Green, Jordan Poole stuff, which is the big NBA news over the course of the last week, because that just seems like a bit of a mess. All the best to everyone involved there. But I have an important announcement for you. The Expendables 4 will release on September 22nd, 2023, when Sylvester Stallone is 77 years old, still just rocking special forces movies, I guess. What a time to be alive, Spins.
Yeah, shout out Sylvester, still doing it. He is the Ric Flair of acting.
Oh my goodness. One last question here. I do think this one is interesting. Is there a possibility at this point the Thompson twins overtake Scoot at number two? I personally don't see it because I don't think Amen is the one that would have the chance. I think Amen is just a bit of a level above Asor at this point. I don't think he has developed enough as a shooter. That's one thing we didn't really talk about with Scoot. Scoot is like a genuinely really high level mid-range shooter. He made 45% of his mid-range shots last year on pull-ups. He's a better shooter than what he gets credit for. Even though he hit like 21% from three last year, we saw a couple of pull-up threes in game one of this series already. I really like Amen. Amen would be number three, I think, on my board right now, maybe four, like three or four with Cam Whitmore, like kind of in that combo there. But I do not see it really as a distinct possibility that Amen Thompson would jump Scoot right now.
Yep, I agree. I think that Amen's ceiling may be a little bit. Am I muted here? You got me?
Yeah, you're good now. Okay.
All right. So I think Amen's ceiling is
There we go.
Oh, man. Killing me here. Amen's ceiling might be a little
bit
higher.
We're good
again. There we go.
Then Scoots.
I think so. I think that if athletically what he's able to do just floating in the air combined with really special passing feel, I can understand why someone would make the argument that Amen's ceiling would be higher than Scoots. I'm not necessarily making it, but I understand why someone would make that argument. But I don't think that there's any way. He can't tap into that between now and the draft where he would overtake Scoot. I don't see that possible.
Yeah, I really like Amen. I think that it would be very hard for him to get there as a shooter from now until then. It's a no for me right now. I don't think you're wrong to say like his ceiling is a little bit higher, but Scoot is just like such a better shooter at this point. Like it's probably like two tiers above. Like it's not just like, oh yeah, like he has to make like one little leap and he's in Scoot's range. Like it's multiple levels at this point.
Yeah. I haven't been five on my board. So like I don't even have him as my clear cut number three because the shooting is such an issue for me in a lot of different ways. But it's more of the recognition of like, could he ever pass Scoot? Only if the shot comes along. I don't see that happening. But if it does, I understand why his ceiling could or would be higher.
Yeah, and like on top of it, Amen is what? Like might be like 14 months older than Scoot, something like that. Like it's not like an insubstantial difference in terms of age either. The same person asked, is Amen Thompson's age going to be a big factor in his draft stock? I don't believe so, but like, I think that he still ends up going in the top like seven or eight for sure. And it's the shooting that will be the factor in his draft stock, not his age, basically.
No. I mean, when you're elite as a prospect. And a lot of times we talk about the difference between, you know, Chet Holmgren being, what, 20 or 21, closer to those ages than somebody who's truly 18 years old the time they come out to the draft. But the first year that these guys are draft eligible, they end up going in the top six or seven because they're a top six or seven talent in any year that they're taken. It's just the first time they're draft eligible based on reclassifying when they were younger, doing postgraduate years. Like it's not about the difference between being, you know, Amen Thompson at 20 when he's draft eligible versus Keegan Murray being 21 by the time he's draft eligible. Yeah. There's a big difference in that regard.
Yeah. Adam, you have to go to practice and do your things. Tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people what's going on in your life.
Yeah, find me on YouTube, my name Adam Spinella, or Twitter, TheBox_1. Obviously going to be coming out with some more stuff following these two miraculous games that we've seen from Victor Wembanyama. But we're knocking on the door of the season here and diving a little bit more to college hoops, which is something that I'm really excited for. But what a fun week this has been, Sam. Thank you for having me on here to debrief a couple of these games. I am going to go and just hit replay on the highlights from Victor Wembanyama and never let a moment from the last couple of days leave my brain because holy crap.
Goodness. Oh, my goodness. I wrote a big breakdown, like a 4,000-word breakdown of the Victor Wembanyama Scoot Henderson game in game one. I think it's genuinely the best prospect game of the 2000s at the very least. I can't really see a case for anything else. So go subscribe to The Athletic. Go and read that story. Adam has released scouting videos from game one, if I remember correctly, as well on YouTube.
Yep.
Yeah, I have not watched them yet, but I know that they exist. I wanted to wait until after I finished my thing to watch them. So I am excited to see those, but I did want to give those a plug. Please go watch Adam's videos over on Adam Spinella YouTube channel. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Adam and I will be back on Sunday to talk. I don't know yet. I don't know what I'm going to make you do yet. I think that probably just wings, probably like NBA draft wings is our next like positional
not
breakdown.
Boneless or bone in barbecue, honey barbecue, not those types of like positional wings.
God, I kind of want wings tonight now. Look at what you've done. I think I'm in. Okay. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do everything you can to support the show. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel, Game Theory Podcast with Sam Vecini. Anything else here? No, I don't think so. Until next time, we will talk soon. Bye.